everybody. I hope you all had a refreshing coffee break and are ready for our final session of our weekend. I'm now going to hand over a moment to Simon, but before I do that, can we just say a very big thank you to all our speakers who've worked so hard to give us an excellent talk this weekend. Thank you. And thank you all for those who've given me questions beforehand. We're going to start off with a little bit of the panel time and then we'll open up to those questions. So be handling those first. Okay, thank you.
Okay, so I think what we've got behind me are these, one of Gordon's slides that shows Aristotle's four causes and then some more contemporary developments of different sorts of causes. And I think because I was talking about at some point how our notion of cause changes through our history of understanding, we keep saying word, but what we mean by it varies, that we, and then I'm sort of arguing, well, perhaps the problem with causality, causation, is that we've come to one narrow concept of it, and we're kind of puzzled as to why we've got so much confusion emanating from that. And it's because of the fact that actually cause might need to be understood in a wider variety of ways. And those ways of understanding cause would be perhaps best described as actually cause is some sort of concept, some sort of conceptualization that we use for the purposes of understanding the derivation of things that happen in the world or changes, and that when we use this notion of causality, we're using it to sort of we have to be flexible in, because we're using it to sort of pursue certain epistemic interests that are important in certain contexts. So there is a sense in which the causation involved in epidemiology is kind of different from the causation that's used in the economics, and the sort of way that causation might be used in child development is perhaps different to how it's used in physics. But there is a point at which we sort of predominantly came to this idea that cause is efficient cause alone, and that has limited our understanding of causality, and that I'm sort of suggesting is the source of confusion. Does that do? Yeah.
Okay, well, I've been asked to just give a brief description of this slide, which I skipped over in the original. So I took Aristotle's four causes, and I'm not an expert in Aristotle, but I know there are experts in your audience who can correct me. But I went through and tried to identify some things which didn't seem to fit into Aristotle's cause. And evolutionary causes, so clearly, as I mentioned at the start of my talk, this stuff that we're made of is a result of an evolutionary process in the universe where we're built inside the nuclear furnace of a supernova. But there's also the wood in this has come from a tree, and that tree has evolved and is there as a tree because of its growth within the environment. So there is an evolutionary cause. Whether it fits into the material cause of the of Aristotle, I'm not in the right place to say. There's financial cause. Who paid for it? You know, this is a table. Aristotle doesn't seem to mention anything about the cost of it or anything. So I'm wondering whether that's a separate cause. Who owns it? Would it be there if it wasn't owned? There's similarly a life cycle cause. A tree is chopped down, the wood is created into a table, and then over time it ages, it becomes unnecessary and it's thrown out. So there's kind of a life cycle cause. there's the business course. Some factories are clearly producing these non-stop on a regular basis, and that probably fits somewhere into the efficient cause. So I think there's a whole lot of causes. And then, of course, you've got this book here called The Philosopher's Table, and the table is being used rhetorically as a means of examining reality. So that's an additional cause which wasn't in the original. But as I said, I'm not an expert on Aristotle, and I know the philosophy of causation has changed a lot since Aristotle's time. But it was just an exercise.
Thank you very much, Gordon. Can I ask if any of our panel members would like to respond back to this more pluralistic?
One sentence.
If Aristotle were here today, he would insist that the word, I think it's aition or aitia, which is translated as cause, is translated as explanation. And most of these problems would evaporate.
I'd just like to reinforce that. The causes there don't address all the questions that anybody might like to ask about that table. They don't ask, for example, why anybody should have arrived at such an incompetent and pointless design for putting glasses on. They don't ask why the owner bought it. They don't ask the question that a dealer might ask about the provenance. They ask a whole lot of questions, or rather a whole lot of causes there that might apply to a table, something made by people, but certainly wouldn't apply to a mosquito. Where on earth has the idea of cause helped anybody in understanding or getting to an explanation of any aspect of that table that actually interests them?
And so now we'll take questions from the floor, the questions that I was given earlier on. So, Eileen, do you have a question?
Right, I did initially think I would like to ask a question about negative causation, because it was something that you guys all referred to. You know, the flowers died because there was an absent cause, the lack of water. But then I started wondering about the answer to that question. And there's an aspect of causation that none of you's dealt with, that the philosophical community is discussing, which is the idea of causal powers, the idea that natural kinds have got intrinsic properties which determine how they behave. So, you know, electrons have negative charge at the very simplest level, you know, and metals expand when heated, kind of thing, you know, and so there is a lot of literature which talks about this, spells it out in detail, but the idea is that causation is really reading off from the way that things operate and interact with each other, that gives rise to the laws. The laws are not something imposed on inert matter. If matter is not inert, matter behaves in a particular, you know, in certain ways, depending on what its nature is, and things interact with each other. And that is the deeper explanation of causation, just like the common theory.
So did anybody want to respond to that?
Well, I just wanted to say that's exactly what I've been arguing, that the interactions are fundamental, and it's from the interactions of objects that we infer things like energy, and we infer the properties of matter, and so on. And I think I'll just stop there for a second.
It's actually quite an interesting question, because if you take a view of the way the world works, you can have what's called a network model. A causes B, B causes C and D, E causes F, G and H. So you've got a kind of very complex system, a giant network. If you think that the nodes of this network are events, then you have a problem with omissions, because omissions are absences, they are non-entities. For example, I could say there's an absence of beer in my fridge, but when I take out the last bottle of beer from my fridge, it doesn't suddenly fill up with something called the absence of beer. It's a non-entity. So, on one model of causation, and if you take causation as a relation needs what are called relata, things that are joined together by the relation. If you think that omissions are simple absences, they are nothing, then you have a relation with no relata. That doesn't make any sense at all. Hugh Miller gets out of it by saying that events aren't the proper relata for causation. He talks in terms of facts, and of course we've got problems with defining facts. The other thing is, if you accept that, as I do, that the relata should be events, and you've got a problem with how you define that event. But there's an interesting thing. If we say they say Flora's omission to water my plants caused them to die, well, Flora's omission isn't an event, so it doesn't fit into an event concept of causation. But we simple it out because, for example, if Flora was the typical good neighbour who was taking it upon herself to be reliable and always water people's plants rather than holiday, then you can see that there's an omission. She has somehow broken a norm of friendship, and her heart and honorary think that we pick out absences and omissions as we treat them as causes, usually when there's some deviation from a norm. Yes.
We had a question from Rebecca.
I'm just wondering, is there some way in which causal powers are a more modern version of material cause? Might be worth thinking about. And the other thing that I'm trying to be interested in is, so one of the things that might stand in the way of how we understand cause is our tendency towards substance ontology, and I'm kind of interested in exploring the idea of process ontology and how that sort of engages with these things like events, interactions and stuff like that. So those might be sort of developments that could be.
You need a substance ontology, I think, for the causal powers here, probably.
Possible.
Yeah.
My question, I must admit, was submitted this morning before I'd heard Ross talk, but so I'll just read it out and then be a bit cheeky, maybe add one extra sentence. Causation is an idea we use to have an effect on the world, or effects on the world. Systematic investigation of causation enables us to treat disease, prevent accidents, and so on. However, as we are not outside the world, but part of it, the same causal processes apply to our actions. Does causation help us as agents in the world while undermining the concept of agency? And I'd like to add a reference to Thomas Nagel, the clash of the subjective and objective points of view. We can take the objective point of view but can't escape the subjective point of view. Does this clash of perspectives, is it inevitably going to cause us discomfort, or should we just forget about it and get on with our lives?
It inevitably causes me discomfort, to think on the one hand I can choose how to answer this question, on the other hand it's determined.
You're not wrong.
So, can you, is this, I'm just not speaking near enough?
No, it was
right. Yes, as I say, it causes me discomfort to think that that I can decide how to answer this question, but of course I can, but at the same time it's determined that I will answer it the way I'm answering it. That does seem a very odd thing. to me, and I was trying to answer that question this morning, I'm not at all satisfied with the second half of my talk, which is meant to be the answer. Because I do think it's a problem that agency is a perfectly good thing, and some things I do because I want to do them, but if somebody pushes me off the stage, my falling off the stage is not an act of agency because I didn't mean to do it. That's a perfectly clear distinction. But also, both those things are equally determined. I can't really get beyond the fact that that's a paradox.
Yes. If I think about my actions, I don't think really about what I've caused, may have been inadvertent. I think about intention. I don't regard myself as the cause, or I'm not bothered about being the cause of something that happened accidentally, even if I was involved in the accident. On the other hand, I do feel responsible for something that I intended to do, even if it didn't actually materialise. So I would separate the whole idea of what I cause from what I'm trying to do as an agent, as something that I ought to be feeling guilty or proud of, etc.
Yeah, I struggle with this to an immensely painful degree. Now, the one thing that the whole issue of determinism is a whole confusing determinism with predeterminism and how we try to understand determinism. So I kind of feel uncomfortable with the idea of Bob going to see the test match tomorrow in Nottingham was sort of predetermined at the point of the Big Bang. I don't see how we can explain that conveniently in those terms. However, if we are going to say that again, let's take a pluralistic approach and say that we are responsible for our actions, and the things that lead up to that action, at the point of action being made, are determined by all the things that we're struggling with to come to a conclusion or an outcome at that point. And when we make that action, it's necessarily the case that that is the only action we could have carried out. Then I'm kind of with that. So I don't know if there's a hard determinism and a soft determinism, and whether I'm just a wishy-washy pragmatist who wants to sit on the fence. the hard determinist issue, I don't feel it captures the reality of human experience. So, but there again, we think somewhere around us, and I think actually the reality of human experience is so.
We have a question from Shiva, if I pronounce that correctly.
Hi, my name is Shiva. I've been a member of the society for 7 or 8 years, but I've never been here, so that's why I know so many. But I have a question for Anne. In your talk, you said that metaphysics is dead, or at least what I gathered from your talk, and that science gives proof to causal relations but not understanding of it. But then I have a confusion with my studying as a theologian. Then how do we separate religion from science if religion and science both need for proof and understanding? So how does that fit into your model? How can religion fit into your model if science sounds like a religion, since it's not just proof, it's understanding, but religion is more understanding than proof?
Am I speaking properly now? Can people hear?
Yes.
I'm not sure that I got the whole drift of the question, but I think I got enough of it to be able to say something. If you're asking me about the position of religion in my ontological model, if that's what you're asking, I would say that, indeed, I wrote a book called Making God. I would say that the God idea, or the religious idea, we can take it further if you like, the God idea is probably one of the most important ideas we've ever had, the human race has ever had. But it is an idea, and like all ideas, it comes, it does whatever work it's going to be doing, and eventually it passes and it goes. And I think that that's what's happening to the religion idea now. And I don't lament that. I'm very pleased that that's happening. Because it seems to me that religion captured a very, very important understanding, for which I thank all those people back in the axial period who began the religions, a very, very important understanding that persons are somehow different from members of the species Homo sapiens. That's not the same thing. A person is not just a member of the species Homo sapiens. But the religious answer there was in terms of, if you like, the specialness of persons there, was in terms of the supernatural, that there are some special relationships which persons have with entities outside the universe, gods or whatever, and that's what enables us to think of persons as different from human animals, Homo sapiens. Now, I think that what's happening now is we're hanging on to that huge insight which the axial period gave us, that persons are something different, but we're coming up slowly and a bit painfully to a different explanation as to what it is that's special about persons. And I would suggest that what it is that's special about persons, which means that we must not go in for any sort of reductionism by explaining persons in terms of what goes on in the biosphere. Members of the species Homo sapiens are in the biosphere. Persons aren't. Persons are not human animals. The best approximation, I think, to getting hold of that was a 19th century one, where it was suggested that a person is the ensemble of social relations. The ensemble of social relations, which obviously isn't an animal. Now, I don't think that is complete. In fact, I don't think our understanding of what a person is complete yet. But I think that sort of thing is on the right track. When I was trying to teach students about this sort of thing, I got students in, say, an audience that is as big as this. The room was as big as this, the audience was bigger. Somebody once at the back got really cross with me. Well, indeed, many students got really cross with me on this thing. And she stood up and she said, "What do you mean, what's a person? This is a person," she said, and sat down. So I've been struggling with this for such a long time, and I said, "Okay, think of it this way. Suppose you went out of this hall at the end of this lecture, and unfortunately you went under a bus. I hope you don't, of course, but we know on a busy road. You went under a bus and you lost both your legs. So you were now, I would say, and I suspect you would say, you are now a lesser Homo sapiens. You're lesser by some number of weight, some number of kilograms. You're lesser by some number of limbs. You've only got two, and most people have got four. You're lesser in some sorts of capacities. You know, playing hopscotch would be difficult. But would any of you want to say that you are a lesser person?" "Oh, no, no, no," says the audience. "That," I said, "is what I'm trying to get at. A person is not a human animal." Now, that doesn't mean, or it doesn't mean for me, that a person is somehow magical. No magic here. For me, what we need to look for, and what I'm trying to look for, is a mechanism, because as you probably gather, I said something serious. I'm trying to find a mechanism which will do for human persons, these ensembles of social relations, what, for example, genes have done to human animals. The mechanism, how do we make a human animal? Well, we say the genes carry the information necessary, we can pass those on through the generations, or each of us can pass on to the one, blah, blah, blah. We need a mechanism as to what can do that for a person, which is not a human animal, and the hypothesis that I'm trying to work on is that that mechanism is the morpheme. Or maybe, I mean, just to put it not too crudely, that is a very, very specific and detailed way of putting it. But if I just say instead, it's words, morphemes and words are not the same thing, but they'll do nearly enough for now. We make each other, I'm trying to argue, by our words, by what we say to other people and what other people say to us. And that causes development, which is not evolution. Development is something totally other than evolution. Development is mutual, you know, between generations across, whereas genes just go down generations. It's mutual, and it is revealing of capacities which these linguistic entities have, that's us, slowly over time. And I think the most important one it's revealing is that we, persons, not human animals, are the only things in reality so far who know how to love. And that's what makes a person, and I can see a little puzzle at the front here. We'll have to talk in terms of what do we mean by love, and I'm quite happy to do that, but that's what persons are capable of. I'm not saying we want to do it, but that's what we're capable of. And if we're capable of that, then we can make worlds which are considerably different from the one we're in at the moment.
Thank you.
Just a one sentence reminder. When Alfred Mealy was sitting on this platform, Anne asked him that very question about the woman falling under a bus and losing both legs. Wouldn't you still be a person? And Alfred said, yes, but a lighter person.
And we have a question from Richard at the front here.
Thank you. This is in relation to Simon Borrington's talk. Is natural selection an example of downward causation?
Well, I think in my talk I suggest that downward causation is something that's developed by D.T. Campbell, who's actually a social psychologist but is involved in a conference on the philosophy of biology. And he makes reference to Dobzhansky, who identifies the fact that adaptation takes place at the level of phenotype, not genotype. So, as I said in my talk, the possible consequences of that are that because the adaptation takes place at the level of phenotype, there must be some sort of information at that level that is transferred downwards that informs the changes that need to take place in the genotype that then becomes sort of instantiated in the DNA template. I mean, I don't know what models we normally use for describing this, I'm probably being very crude, but takes an instantiated change in the DNA templates which then sort of continue to genetically propagate the adaptations into the more successful. So it's not really my field of expertise, but I would like to think that possibly yes. Is my short answer.
Thank you. Yes, I go for the Darwin's finches, so that the shape of the beak is clearly influenced by the genes of the finch, and so natural selection will work on the genes of the finch by the survival of the finch because of its different beak and different food that it eats. And that's exactly what Fancy said.
We have a question from Chris Hurst. Chris Hurst in the room.
Oh, sorry. No, it's been answered. Yeah, it's been answered. Bob answered it.
Oh, it's been answered.
Paul and Twistle.
Sorry, Stuart, you're having to
rather.
I've got this one.
Oh,
sorry.
Okay. James through. Yes, sorry. It can't be answered by Bob. It was a. Of course. It's working. No.
All right. Then.
Okay.
Thank you very much. It was a concern that we were trying to force fit all sorts of phenomena into this
idea of cause and causation. And I just get very nervous when I'm told that I'm allowed to use this word cause in all sorts of guises. And I like the idea of explanation rather than cause, but I wouldn't want one to displace the other. I would very much like to have the option of the shorthand of putting something into one sentence, which, for instance, might require 25 sentences for proper explanation. And I will use the word explanation and cause very much in the same breath. And it was really just a plea that we don't try and force that cause too tightly.
Can I just introduce a new term, which is necessary cause? And so, with the case of cholera, which I showed, having the pathogen and swallowing it and it growing in your gut is a necessary cause of the disease. But there are all sorts of other things which influence the disease which aren't the necessary cause. So some of those might best be described as descriptions. I think the necessary cause is a good way of describing it as a cause. So I have a slight difference with my colleague here in terms of the use of the word cause.
No, I hope not. I have no objection whatever to somebody using the term cause, especially if they're then prepared to explain how the cause works. What I was objecting to was the idea of causation as some kind of process which underlay all sorts of uses of the term cause, which I don't think it does.
So I think this is exactly Carl Hempel's point. He wanted to do away with the notion of causation because it's metaphysical, with all sorts of metaphysical implications. He wants to talk something in terms of explanations, but then of course you end up with a whole lot of other philosophers jumping on that, and you get a plurality of what explanation is. And then you end up with the sort of situation where you're talking about causal explanation. So we now got these two vague terms conjoined, in which we're, you know, so this is the game that philosophy is, isn't it, really? You know, so.
Yes.
Going back to Aristotle, if you would ask him an explanation for why this table is a table, a causal explanation. It's quite a simple term. It's where the native friend who made the table, or possibly the person who ordered it, or things happened in the past. But another explanation for why it's a table is because tables are defined as X, Y, Z, and this is X, Y, Z, so it's a table by definition. That's not a causal explanation. So there are different types of explanation, and I think the expression causal explanation, or just cause, it's a perfectly valid one, which we can use quite happily and communicate quite happily with each other in everyday life, which is really how what justifies, I think, use of the word.
Yeah.
It is a fact, I think, that most philosophers will agree that there's a distinct possibility that our notion of cause is disjunctive, that is, it may cover a whole series of related similar ideas but which are not identical. In fact, Ned Hall, who was a pupil of David Lewis, has written a paper where he talks about two causes, two concepts of causation. The point is that he feels that the debate so far has revealed certain tensions. It may be the two dissipate these tensions. We do need a plurality of causal concepts that, as someone pointed out, may have a family resemblance in a Wittgensteinian sense, but despite related, have different uses. So the philosophers are actually moving in this direction.
We have a question from Paul Entwistle.
Hello, Paul. My question is about concepts of randomness and probability.
and to what extent they may help inform our debate, or whether they are in fact a red herring. I'd like to add a little bit of background to that. There have been several mentions through the course of the last 24 hours. Certainly Bob has referred to randomness and probability, and I have understood it as being a sort of an alternative to determinism, and we have to acknowledge that there's maybe something else going on somewhere. In terms of the observed everyday world, I would like to suggest that what we talk about as randomness, such as the throwing of dice or a ball on a roulette wheel, are in fact nothing of the sort, and that in each distinct case of throwing a die, for example, the outcome as to whether it is a one or a six is completely determined by the forces in play at the time it is thrown and the surface it lands on. And I don't think many would dispute that. The reason we talk about probability and randomness in that concept is because the unaided human brain cannot assess what the outcome would be, so we talk of it in terms of probability. The only arena, and I speak completely as a lay person, where true randomness seems to exist is in the area or the areas of quantum physics and nuclear physics. And it can perhaps be argued that there is some determinism there, we just don't have the faintest idea what it is yet. Even a random number generator, I would suggest, must have an underlying algorithm to function in the first place. So back to my question, do the concepts of randomness and probability help us with issues such as free will and causation, or are they broadly a red herring?
Broadly a red herring. I think what you said about probability in the real world, in a middle-sized world, is absolutely spot on. I mean, everything to do with probability is a feature of our ignorance. It's not a feature of the universe. But in the case of, I'm trying to get this right, in the case of quantum mechanics, something like the decay of uranium, for instance, I gather that, given that I know nothing about this, I gather from people who think they do. I gather people who claim to be physicists, it is determined that the atoms will decay at a certain rate. But it's purely random, and intrinsically random, not just we don't know, according to one interpretation anyway, it's intrinsically random which order they will decay in. So there's a mixture of determinism and randomness, but as a result of that you can say that the probability of that atom there decaying within the next 50 years is X. So that's a mixture of determinism and randomness which produces inherent probability in the universe, assuming that interpretation is correct. If there's randomness of another sort in the universe, for instance, decision making, it's possible there again, but it may be determined that I'm going to do one of six things this afternoon, and just by pure intrinsic randomness, my mind hit on the idea of driving to Nottingham. I find that extremely difficult to take on board, but that's what probability, intrinsic probability in decision making would mean if it meant anything. But I don't actually think it does mean that.
Okay.
Is it coming across?
Yeah.
As far as the determination of the causal determination which affects persons, I just would like to reiterate what I think I heard mainly coming from Ted Hondrick, but some others as well, that the very worst thing that we might want to think that we are being forced to do is to believe that our behaviour is random. It's difficult enough for some people, for me, to believe that our behaviour is totally determined, but if the only alternative is to believe that our behaviour is random, that I might murder my mother just because a random event caused me so to do, there is nothing more alarming about what a human being might be, or a human person might be, than to think that its behaviour has got anything at all to do with randomness. Whatever you think about randomness down at the subatomic level.
This isn't an area of expertise for me at all, really. So there's all sorts of problems. So there's issues around chaotic dynamics, for example, where outcomes appear random simply on the basis of slight changes in starting points. So the very fact that so they could be determined. Well, they are determined, and you could trace that back, but we don't know it because we don't know what variation the starting point is at the time it starts, etc. So I find the thing that remains, and this probably is just a lack of knowing the conditions under which the process starts. And when we think about how many possible events in the causal nexus there might be for any one event, you know, it's kind of no wonder it appears random.
A question from Paul. Did you still want to ask you a question?
Which you've got there, and I'm trying to remember it. I can vague. Yes, if I had a microphone.
Right.
Hold on a moment.
Yes.
I suppose my question, as much as I can remember, is initially addressed to Jeff and your interesting talk. And I thought it was great that you actually had two balls, blue and red, and we can see what's going on, because I'm really being very simplistic here. I want to talk about the Humean idea of a very simple event, not complicated chaos or anything, initially to say what we really think by cause. And I was quite cheered along when you say it got halfway there, that is an event, and it was getting closer and closer. Then I got very disappointed when you used the word interaction, and you seem to substitute that for a cause, and then you say, well, this is the law, and this is Newtonian physics, which I sort of agree in principle. It was, they're the same mass, so, and the blue ball stopped, and the other ball continued. That's conservation momentum, I think, you know, simple. And that's fine, and we can observe it. But then you seem to say this is now predicated on this idea of interaction, and that just seems to be a substitute for cause. Well, Hume's point was very much, I see this, and every time I see it, there is a constant conjunction, but there is no connection. But I think you were conflating the interaction with connection, and so really we haven't got any further in the debate about that. I actually think there is an a priori idea that we are the way we look at the universe, and I'm hesitant to use the word necessary, but we very much, every time we see a ball hit another ball, we impose upon that, if we want to use the word cause. I agree with that. I do not see it totally logically or actually necessary in the ordinary sense. It's just that's the way we think, and that's the way we maybe have to think to survive, because if we see this happen, then we expect it to happen. But I'm still not really moving very far from you. I'm not sure what really you added to the debate further than Hume. You changed the words, and I think there is a real semantic problem. I look at that list there, and most of the word cause, is not, it's redundant. You just say, who is the owner? He said ownership cause. Well, the owner is Mr. X. Who is the business? What was the business? We don't need this word. I think we're confusing it. I think we need to be very specific about what cause is. Yeah.
Let me try and answer that. And in fact, what I'm going to do, because Paul's here asking me to do, is summarise my whole of my talk. The philosophical problem of causation has two components. And one component is causation in the world. And in causation in the world, what I showed, I hope, was that causation in the world, it consists of interactions. The second component is our concept of causation. And what I'm arguing is that our concept of causation does not align with causation in the world. And it's several people have got confused about why I'm saying that our talk is nonsense. And the reason is that our causal language does not align with causation in the world. So when people say that this ball causes that ball to move, what they're saying is not true. They are confused. It's not true that the blue ball caused the red, the movement of the blue ball caused the red ball to move. It's not true that Mary caused the flowers to die, and it's not true that the car running out of petrol caused the car to stop. And these are examples that you'd find if you did a course on the philosophy of causation. So that this is my big point. The two things are different. There's a concept and there's causation in the world. Causation in the world is interactions. Interactions are rock bottom. Everything in science is built on interactions. There's nothing changes in this world without an interaction. And changes are the key thing to hang on to. This is what the whole subject is about. Sorry. Understanding change. So if someone gives you an example that's problematic, what you've got to look for is where's the interaction in this. So in the case of Mary not watering the flowers, I'd say, well, where's the interaction? There is no interaction. It's nonsense.
Yeah, I know. I'm purposely not going down that line. That's my point. Your example is nice and simple, and you said actually you could isolate it in the middle of space and no other forces. I still think it's... Yes, I agree, there's an interaction. It collides. You can use all these words about what goes on. It's just this idea, is there a connection? I'm really analysing, trying to analyse what Hume really means, and I don't think you take it any further. I agree there's an interaction, and the second ball moves on.
I have to take it no further than Hume. Hume, I take, is supporting my position. Hume said that you have this concept of causation that you all use, but you don't understand it.
I agree, yeah.
And he's right, and that's what I'm saying.
We have one question from Paul that was given in. Oh, sorry, Bob.
I'll just add that. I think Jeff is quite wrong here. but to say that the car stopped because it ran out of petrol is the only appropriate answer to the question that the police ask you when you're stuck on the half shoulder. Why does your car stop here?
So that's an explanation.
And then you say, well, the reason is that they ran out of petrol. Now, that is the cause. Now, if you might say to the policeman, well, the reason is that this law of Newton's about motion and inertia and so on, and there's a certain amount of friction on the half shoulder, and the policeman's like, hey, you're having an answer. the cause, the way you describe the cause, depends on what is relevant to the person who asked you. And if you were asked that same question as question 5 in a physics exam, you might say the car ran out of petrol and stopped. Why? Then of course you'd get a completely different answer. In neither case are you talking nonsense. It's just you might want to explain why the car running out of petrol made it stop. You might want to explain why Mary's not watering the flowers made them die, or that they died because Mary didn't water them. Perfectly sensible thing to say. But of course, if you gave a full explanation, it would include the whole history of the universe as well, and you haven't got time. And the police wouldn't stand for it.
Right, well, so you're wrong. There is another explanation of why the car stopped. Okay? And are you saying that that explanation is wrong? That those frictional forces didn't apply? Your explanation is not an explanation.
It's not complete.
The problem is, actually, it's wrong. And the problem is that philosophers are using this concept of causation. As a consequence, they can't come up with an account of causation. They've been at it for 250 years, And the reason they're not making progress is all of these theories are based on nonsense.
If we go back to Flora's absence and her refusal to water my plants, I think Jeff said there's no interaction. Well, there is. The point is that flowers die because of the dehydration process. What prevents that dehydration process is Flora's regular watering. Once that preventer is removed, then the other mechanism does kick in. So what we have here is a complex system of prevention as part of the causal structure. Underlying this is that to say that Flora's absence and her refusal to water my plants caused them to die is perfectly acceptable shorthand to cover this slightly more complex analysis where you have a process and something which prevents that process taking place. This is quite common. Any number of thought experiments involve the notion of hasteners, delayers, and preventers. I think you just need to sort of analyse the situation. And I think I agree with Bob that as a quick shorthand explanation, the absence of petrol in my car or the refusal of Flora to continue watering my plants, perfectly good explanations. And we do rely on this. Of course, to say it's absolute nonsense, I think it's simply just a step too far. Sorry, Jeff.
What I want to say is what I've been focused on is trying to solve this problem of causation. That's been my focus, to solve the problem. Now, if you allow that causes can be things that didn't happen and things that are not actually present in the causal situation, you will never ever come up with a satisfactory account of causation. It's just not going to happen. It's never going to happen. And we'll still be struggling with this in 250 years. That's why.
It depends on what you regard as the relator of the causal process. Say, as we mentioned humour before, if you take facts as the appropriate relator for a causal relationship, then the fact that Flora didn't water my plants is a perfectly good summation of that particular relatum. So there are alternative theories. I prefer the event-based theories, but there are others on the market. And the philosopher's task is to try to winnow down the alternatives and see what best suits our purposes.